Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, from Inside Higher Ed, and from Fast Company. Today's program is generously supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424, and we thank them for their contribution. The contents of this program are intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Got a couple of sources today on the program that we haven't featured before, and I'm going to start with those. And the first one comes from Inside Higher Ed, which is a trade publication for higher education. And the title of this column or this article is LGBTQ Rights versus Religious Liberties. And the subheadline, Religious Colleges Say Supreme Court Decision Finding That Federal Anti-Discrimination Law Protects LGBTQ Employees Could Open Their Policies Up to Challenge. This is by Elizabeth Redden of Inside Higher Ed. Advocates for religious colleges say Monday's Supreme Court decision ruling that employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity is illegal under federal law raises unanswered questions and concerns for them. The 6-3 ruling holds that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, by extension protects gay and transgender individuals from being fired for reasons related to their sexual orientation or gender identity. An employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex, says the opinion, which was authored by Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed by President Trump. Sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids. 22 states, plus the District of Columbia, already have laws prohibiting employers from discriminating against employees based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But even some in higher education praised the ruling. Peter McPherson, the president of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, issued a statement applauding this landmark advancement of human rights. Lily Eskelson Garcia, the president of the National Education Association, a labor organization that includes K-12 teachers as well as college faculty among its membership, similarly praised the decision as a significant step toward LGBTQ equality. The message is plain and simple. Our LGBTQ educators and students matter. Full stop, she said. But some religious colleges viewed the ruling with concern. Some religious colleges have rules against hiring LGBT employees and view sexual activity outside the bounds of a marriage between a man and a woman as grounds for termination. Advocates for religious colleges see their ability to consider sexual orientation and gender identity in employment decisions as matters of religious liberty, and they worry that opening up a new front for individuals to sue religious colleges over their policies on LGBTQ employees under federal anti-discrimination law will make them more vulnerable to lawsuits. Religious colleges wouldn't be defenseless in such lawsuits. Title VII includes an exemption for religious employers, including religious educational institutions, giving them the right to prioritize members of their own religion in hiring. And there are other established legal avenues through which colleges seek exemptions from federal and state anti-discrimination laws. None of the employers whose cases were before the Supreme Court claimed religious exemptions. One of the employers, a funeral home, unsuccessfully pursued a defense based on religious freedom grounds, but it had not sought review of its religious liberty claim by the Supreme Court. And Gorsuch wrote that future cases would have to take up questions regarding the applicability of such exemptions. Gorsuch wrote that worries about how Title VII may intersect with religious liberties are nothing new, and he cited the express statutory exception for religious organizations written into Title VII. This court has also recognized that the First Amendment can bar the application of employment discrimination laws to claims concerning the employment relationship between a religious institution and its ministers, he wrote. And Congress has gone a step further yet in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. That statute prohibits the federal government from substantially burdening a person's exercise of religion unless it demonstrates that doing so both furthers a compelling governmental interest and represents the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. But how these doctrines protecting religious liberty interact with Title VII are questions for future cases, too, Gorsuch wrote. The Council of Christian Colleges and Universities, along with Catholic University of America, a Roman Catholic institution, and Brigham Young University, an institution affiliated with The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, submitted an amicus brief in the case arguing that Title VII's prohibition on sex discrimination should not be interpreted to include discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The religious colleges argued in the brief that altering the settled meaning of Title VII would negatively impact faith-based institutions of higher education in significant and far-reaching ways. They argue that Congress, not the Supreme Court, is better suited to address issues concerning LGBTQ rights and employment, while protecting the ability of religious educational institutions to continue pursuing their unique religious missions. The amicus brief acknowledges the exemptions that apply to religious universities, but it said the scope of the exemptions is contested among lower courts. The colleges argued any uncertainty associated with the application of these statutory exemptions to sex discrimination claims would be even greater if a religious university had to rely on a statutory exemption to protect its religious standards against a claim of LGBTQ discrimination. The particular concerns are how this new clear statement of civil rights for LGBTQ people will intersect with very clear Title VII religious protections, said Shirley Hoekstra, president of the Council of Christian Colleges and Universities. Under Title VII, religious organizations are permitted to give employment preference to members of their own religion, Hoekstra continued. Will that include the beliefs of that religion? For instance, let's say that whether you're Jewish, Muslim, Christian, if you believe counterculturally that marriage is between a man and a woman, and you prefer to hire people who share that religious belief as your faculty and staff, will you be able to do that in the employment context? We would say yes, that was the purpose of the religious protections. It's to actually allow belief to be practiced in an unfettered way. But it's possible that would be challenged. John Garvey, the president of Catholic University of America, said the impact of the decision remains to be seen. When we wrote the brief, our concern was there's any number of ways in which this can affect us, not only under Title VII, but also under Title IX of the Education Amendments Act of 1972, which prohibits sex-based discrimination in educational institutions. The brief raises questions about potential impacts on student housing, for example. At least one expert on Title IX expects the Supreme Court decision will lead to an increase in court cases challenging colleges on policies related to gender-separated living facilities and sports teams. The people who signed on to the brief at various Catholic, Lutheran, Presbyterian, LDS, evangelical schools, they're all pretty serious about the way they run their universities, Garvey said. It's a matter of bringing up young men and women to live their lives in a certain way, and we don't like to be hypocritical in doing that. So we take seriously the fact that marriage is a sacrament that we administer for men and women and not others. And we take seriously the idea that God created men and women and separate sexes, and that's part of the natural order of things. Greg Nevins, the director of the Employment Fairness Project and senior counsel at Lambda Legal, a nonprofit organization that advocates for LGBTQ civil rights, said it's striking that much of the opposition to interpreting Title VII to include LGBTQ protections came from religious entities in light of the fact that religiously claimed exemptions were not at issue in the specific cases before the Supreme Court. The decision would seem to affect them less than many other employers, just in terms of the exemptions that already exist in the law, Nevins said. They do have a lot of arrows in the quiver, but it's a matter of figuring out which one is appropriate, or maybe if none of them are, they have to follow the law, like everyone else. We'll turn next to an article from Fast Company magazine dated June 15th. And this is an article titled, Churches Are Closed, But Religion Has a New Home on the Internet. And the subheadline, Amid the Coronavirus Pandemic, Houses of Worship Have Been Forced to Figure Out How to Bring Services, Rituals, and Other Religious Practices Online in an Engaging Way. This article is by Stephen Melendez of Fast Company. In ordinary times, about a third of Americans say they attend religious services at least once a week, according to the Pew Research Center. But during the coronavirus pandemic, houses of worship across the country have shut their doors along with other public places. Some states have begun to ease restrictions and allow in-person worship to resume amid public and presidential pressure. But many leaders don't plan on reopening yet, concerned about spreading the virus. And even institutions that are reopening know many members are still wary of venturing out. I think until there's a vaccine, and even after there's a vaccine for this COVID-19, you're going to have people that are cautious, says Phil Thompson, vice president and streaming video specialist at Arizona-based StreamingChurch.tv, which provides digital services to churches. That's meant that houses of worship, traditionally a spiritual and social home for members, have had to find ways to reach people confined to their physical houses. Institutions like churches, synagogues, and mosques have quickly sought to bring services and rituals online in ways that honor their religious traditions while still engaging members who could easily click away to Netflix or Spotify. We had just a major influx of brand new people wanting to learn this streaming thing and figure out how it's going to work, says StreamingChurch.tv founder and CEO Steve Lacey. We kind of felt like there was a rush on toilet paper, and we were the toilet paper providers. It was really crazy. Lacey's company lets churches broadcast live and recorded sermons and events through their websites, social media platforms like Facebook, and streaming platforms like YouTube and Roku. The company provides provides customer service to help digitally unsure pastors get services online, often using computers and video equipment they already have in the church or at home. It also offers a range of opinions, such as multilingual digital Bibles that parishioners can access, live chats and prayer requests that can be facilitated by church volunteers, and even automated messages to check in on members who may not have virtually attended for a while. If someone doesn't show up for a few weeks, it will send an email. "We missed you," said Thompson. StreamingChurch.tv isn't the only religion-focused streaming service. Some religious leaders may prefer to do business with those who share their spiritual philosophies, and some are wary of broadcasting through mainstream platforms like YouTube or Facebook. There are also some concerns people have, depending on their theology, of utilizing some of these platforms and relying on them, says Matt Frazier, president of church streaming service Truthcasting. Some religious leaders are concerned about unrelated video recommendations that might pop up after their services air on non-religious sites, he said. Those leaders also know that even if they're not broadcasting through YouTube, Facebook, or Roku, those platforms are only a click of a mouse or tap or a remote control away from when the faithful are watching from the family couch, not tucked into pews alongside their neighbors. That means they have to not only become acquainted with what might have been unfamiliar technology, but they also need to adapt their traditions to engage their adherents online, all while interpreting religious laws and customs that might prefer in-person rituals or restrict the use of technology. On the other hand, some faith communities have found that moving online has helped attract new visitors or win back lapsed members, including some people who couldn't easily get to houses of worship because of distance, schedule conflicts, or disability. While the new style of worship is a challenge for some, others report it's making religion more accessible than ever. Until the virus outbreak, online religion was often the province of people dissatisfied with some aspect of their local institutions who were looking for extra spiritual support rather than a mainstream way to attend church, says sociologist Tim Hutchins. An assistant professor of religious ethics at the University of Nottingham, he's researched online religion since 2005. After some initial experimentation in the early days of the Internet, many churches have focused more on in-person connections than digital preaching, he says. Suddenly, the church of tomorrow is back again, he says. The dead future has come back. Ideally, religious leaders are learning the digital church of tomorrow isn't just a traditional sermon broadcast through a webcam or posted as a podcast. During the pandemic, that's sometimes not even an option. Clergy may be broadcasting from home out of caution, and traditional service elements like choirs and bands may not be able to gather in person, requiring some experimentation. We've seen some really creative things, says Sam Brenner, chief operating officer at the Cleveland-based streaming service Boxcast. Some people are Zooming in various musicians. But some religious leaders are also finding traditional services aren't a great way to reach people distracted by the temptations and duties of home. Sitting in front of a computer for an hour for a Sunday service is not an easy thing to do, says Joe Garcia, who works with streaming technology at the Center for Spiritual Living in Reno, Nevada, where his wife, the Reverend Lisa Garcia, is senior minister. It's very easy watching something on your computer to get distracted, so we have to make it engaging. Services at the center are available for live streaming with the help of StreamingChurch.tv, but afterward the church typically only posts the minister's message and a portion of the church service, while omitting other elements like announcements and some of the music. Other institutions have taken steps to engage more directly with at-home congregations. Steve Ely, lead pastor at Oklahoma's Passion Church, uses truthcasting to get material online. Sermons are mostly pre-recorded, but a live host appears on camera before and after to take prayer requests, ask questions. On Mother's Day, we asked for a favorite memory with your mom, Ely recalls, and digitally chat with churchgoers. That typically lasts anywhere from 5 to 15 minutes after the sermon. As long as the comments are continuing, they stay in front of the camera, Ely says. Some houses of worship also use different platforms for different purposes. Parkside Church, in the Cleveland suburb of Chagrin Falls, has worked with Boxcast to put sermons online, initially primarily for churchgoers who are traveling or homesick. Now that's naturally reaching a broader audience, says media director Bruce Coffey, while prayer meetings and other interactive group events have migrated to Zoom. It's kind of interesting because you can peek into everybody's home a little bit, he quips. From business conferences to concerts, organizers of all kinds of events have had to decide what elements will keep people engaged in an online forum. But religious institutions not only have to consider audience attention spans, they also have to reconcile the necessities of the pandemic with often centuries-old religious laws and traditions. Rabbi Mark Bloom of Temple Beth Abraham in Oakland, California, started video streaming the conservative Jewish synagogue services on YouTube, the synagogue's website, and social media in response to the pandemic. Services are fairly similar to what they would be in person, he says, and there have been positive comments from members, with attendance counts for Saturday services higher than they were in person. Still, services are somewhat shorter due to religious rules requiring a quorum of at least 10 people for certain elements, and some elements just aren't possible in a streaming context, he says. There's a lot of ceremony around the Torah itself that happens. You bring it to the people, everybody touches it, he says. That's one that I think people miss entirely. Jewish communities have also wrestled with rules that limit some uses of technology on the Sabbath, with different congregations coming to different interpretations about what's permissible in connecting their members. And other religions have faced their own challenges. Muslims around the world observe Ramadan without in-person communal prayer or fast-breaking meals, and Christians skip to reimagine traditional church processions for Palm Sunday and services for Easter. Different Christian denominations have also taken different approaches to communion, says Heidi Campbell, a communications professor at Texas A&M University, who studies online religion. Some encourage members to provide their own ritual bread and wine, and others, including Roman Catholics, prefer spiritual communion without the physical elements until services can resume. Our services are so incarnational, says Josh Simmons, CEO of eCatholic, which provides digital services to Catholic churches, speaking of the importance of Mass, where Jesus is believed to be physically present in communion. It's not just scripture and a homily and great music. It's an experience every time you go there. Streaming services have given some people the opportunity to virtually visit different houses of worship than they might otherwise attend. Simmons says some Catholics have been digitally attending Mass at churches far from their home parishes for a variety of reasons, including many worshiping with St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York when the city was hit hard by the pandemic. It's been a way for people to be in solidarity with the people in New York, to go to Masses and hear Cardinal Timothy Dolan speak, he says. Simmons says he and his family used the opportunity to virtually worship with a church in a city they formerly lived in. It was still kind of near and dear to our hearts, he says, and knows of others making similar online visits. Maybe it's a church they grew up in and they haven't been to in 30 years, he says. Then they can show their kids, this is where I received my first communion, or this is where I was baptized. Worshippers across religious lines are also taking advantage of online streaming to drop in on institutions they've been curious about socially or theologically without the constraints of geography or the intimidation factor of dropping in on a new congregation. Many online streaming platforms let broadcasters see where attendees are logging in from, and religious leaders have spotted new faces from around the world, drawn in by word of mouth or social media. I think a lot of people are looking around, says Campbell. Some of it is just curiosity, and some of it is dissatisfaction. Some of those visitors may also be people who found it physically difficult to attend church in the past. Relaxed work-from-home rules have been a boon to some people with disabilities and others who had difficulties with traditional office life and commutes. Similarly, online worship has made it easier for some people to comfortably attend religious services. In many communities, there are people who are housebound, they've moved into a care home, they're disabled. For some reason, they're not able to get to church every week, says Hutchings. There are some people for whom the pandemic has been a new accessibility of church. We'll turn next to Religion News Service and a column dated June 17th. And the title of this opinion piece is 5 years after shooting, Mother Emanuel uneasily adopts as pilgrimage site. This article is by Matthew J. Kressler of Religion News Service, Dateline Charleston, South Carolina. Before the COVID-19 pandemic forced Mother Emanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church to live stream its services, visitors to the Holy City, as Charleston is sometimes called, could often be spotted wandering outside taking photos of the facade. Worship on a given Sunday night might include people from across the U.S. and some foreign countries come to pray at what they take to be a sacred site. Such was the curiosity and reverence for the social hall on the ground floor, where 9 members of the church were killed by a white supremacist in 2015, that a sign eventually went up asking visitors not to photograph the space. In the 5 years since the murders at a Wednesday evening Bible study, Mother Emanuel has continued to serve as a spiritual home to its members. At the same time, they recognize that the oldest AME church in the southern United States has also become something else, a pilgrimage site, a tourist destination. Mother Emanuel members remain divided over what to make of these visitors. Liz Alston, the church's historian and a longtime member, told me recently that at first there were a few members who felt invaded by having strangers every Sunday. Her take on things is different. "I was the one who would be called in to talk to many of the people," Alston said. "It was just a sense of giving back that we would welcome visitors into our pews. You're welcome to come in," she would say. "We're Christians." The transformation began almost immediately and without any forethought. "The murders were just so horrifying," recalled Celeste Wiley, the visual materials archivist for the South Carolina Historical Society. "It wasn't even 24 hours before the sidewalk in front of the church was just overflowing with tributes that had been left." Upon seeing this, Wiley thought, "I immediately thought, oh, someone needs to come take care of those." In the middle of June in the South Carolina Lowcountry, she said, "you can expect torrential rainstorms half an hour every day." At first, volunteers at the church periodically moved the makeshift memorials off the street to protect them, but quickly the church was overrun. "It was also upsetting for a lot of the congregation to have that there," said Wiley. Eventually, the Charleston Archives, Libraries, and Museum Council stepped in. This consortium of cultural institution professionals came together in 1989 in the wake of Hurricane Hugo to protect historical memory and archival materials from natural disasters. Now it was a human disaster that was calling the council to action. Almost a year after the shooting, a tribute to Mother Emanuel Church, a digital archive co-curated by several local archival initiatives in partnership with Mother Emanuel, opened to the public, funded in part by the College of Charleston's Race and Social Justice Initiative. At the South Carolina Historical Society, in addition, the collection of letters to the church extends 75 linear feet. There's correspondence from 47 states and 5 countries in one box alone. One letter from overseas was addressed simply to the church in South Carolina. "That's the only thing that's on the envelope, and it got me," Wiley said. When the shooting occurred, the Reverend Maurice J. Nutt, a Redemptorist Catholic priest, had just been named director of the Institute for Black Catholic Studies at Xavier University of Louisiana, a historically black school in New Orleans and the only Catholic HBCU in the United States. "I had to preach on the massacre in my opening mass as director," Nutt told me. "It set the theme for my time there, which would include organizing Black Lives Matter forums at the university." But this coincidence wasn't the only way the massacre marked him. Like the Kennedy or King assassinations, he reflected, the Mother Emanuel massacre was one of those events you could remember precisely where you were when you heard the news. In October of last year, Nutt and I toured Mother Emanuel with 30 other members of the Black Catholic Theological Symposium, which was meeting in Charleston. I am an affiliate member of the organization as a white Catholic. Nutt is the current convener of the BCTS, which fosters scholarly community among Black Catholics and those devoted to the study of Black Catholic theology, history, and culture. BCTS annual meetings always involve a tour of local Black Catholic and African American historic sites, and in planning the meeting it became clear that Mother Emanuel ranked high on the sites members hoped to see. Our time there opened with a tour of the sanctuary and a talk by an elder of the community on the history of the congregation and the building itself. When it came time for questions, it was clear that many BCTS members wanted to know how Mother Emanuel congregants were coping with the losses of June 17, 2015. Our tour guide seemed reluctant to say much on the matter. While Mother Emanuel's pastor, the Reverend Eric S.C. Manning, addressed us at the end of our tour, he admitted that many were still in various stages of grief and recovery. It gets weary having to tell the story again and again, he said, and the steady stream of visitors forces some members to relive the tragedy again and again. Our own time as visitors in those pews ended in prayer. 32 of us joined hands with the pastor and the few Mother Emanuel members who were there that day to pray the litany in remembrance of the massacre at Mother Emanuel, composed 5 years ago by the Reverend Nichelle R. Guidry, Dean of Spelman College Chapel. The litany of sorrow and mourning asks, "How long, O Lord, will you forget us forever? How long will you hide your face from us? How long must we take counsel in our soul and have sorrow in our hearts all day?" Then we cried out the names of the 9 lives lost: Reverend Clementa Pinckney, Reverend Sharonda Singleton, Myra Thompson, Tawanza Sanders, Ethel Lee Lance, Cynthia Hurd, Reverend Daniel L. Simmons Sr., Reverend DePayne Middleton Doctor, and Susie Jackson. It concluded, "God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, in the midst of this chaos, call us now to revolutionary faith that resists doubt, fear, and hopelessness." We'll wrap up religion in the news this week with a short article from the Associated Press. West Point graduates its first observant Sikh woman. Dateline Roswell, Georgia, from June 13th. The United States Military Academy at West Point will make history Saturday when it graduates the first observant Sikh woman to successfully complete the path to a 4-year degree. Second Lieutenant Anmol Narang is a second-generation immigrant born and raised in Roswell, Georgia. She did a year of undergraduate study at the Georgia Institute of Technology before transferring to West Point, where she will graduate Saturday with a degree in nuclear engineering. She hopes to pursue a career in air defense systems. "I am excited and honored to be fulfilling my dream of graduating from West Point," Narang said in a news release from the Sikh Coalition, a nonprofit based in New York that works to protect the constitutional right to practice faith without fear. "The confidence and support of my community back home in Georgia has been deeply meaningful to me, and I am humbled that in reaching this goal, I am showing other Sikh Americans that any career path is possible for anyone willing to rise to the challenge." Narang will complete her basic officer leadership course at Fort Sill in Lawton, Oklahoma, officials said. Following that, she will then head to her first post in Okinawa, Japan, in January. Other Sikhs have graduated from the academy, but the coalition says Narang is the first observant Sikh woman to do so. Congress passed a law in 1987 that prohibited Sikhs and other religious communities from maintaining their articles of faith while in the military. A Sikh's visible articles of faith, including turbans and unshorn facial hair, were banned. Narang required no accommodation for her articles of faith, but the coalition said her exemplary service to date underscores how diversity and pluralism remain core strengths of the U.S. military and the country as a whole. U.S. Army Captain Simrat Pal Singh, a family friend, said he is proud of Narang, who is breaking a barrier for any Sikh American who wishes to serve. The broader acceptance of Sikh service members among all of the service branches, as well as in top-tier leadership spaces like West Point, will continue to benefit not just the rights of religious minority individuals, but the strength and diversity of the U.S. military, he said. Well, that's it for our time this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and our program today was supported by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. We thank them for their contribution. Don't forget that this program is available as a podcast by visiting our website, ncreadingservice.org. Click on the Listen tab, and you can find Religion in the News in the podcast section. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and we'll talk to you next time on Religion in the News.